When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my new series, Parrish. My character, Gray Parrish, was a getaway driver.
I'm retired from life, you know that.
He's in a world over his head.
Tell me about this driver job.
And he's asked to start to figure things out.
I did what you told me to.
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC+.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. My guest today is a photojournalist whose 5 decades of work have truly run the gamut, covering politics, sports, travel, music, and entertainment. His wide-ranging career includes conflict journalism, celebrity portraiture, and travel photography. It's Brooklyn's own Brian Hamill. Hamill rose to prominence as the on-set still photographer for movies like Annie Hall, Raging Bull, Manhattan, Tootsie, Bullets Over Broadway, and You've Got Mail. The list goes on and on. He has photographed the most famous personalities of our time, from Muhammad Ali to Frank Sinatra and Barbra Streisand. He's even captured some of the most iconic images ever taken of John Lennon and Yoko Ono, which were compiled into his recent book, Dream Lovers, John and Yoko in New York City. Brian Hamill is a lifelong New Yorker who comes from an incredibly talented stock. He's the child of Irish immigrants, one of 7. His brothers, Dennis and the late Pete Hamill, both became acclaimed columnists, journalists, authors, and screenwriters. Hamill and I have been friends for decades. I began our conversation by sharing one of my favorite memories of him. There's a story I tell. I want to take a woman on a date, and I want to go to have dinner with you. And you go, and I'll never forget this, you go, what day of the week is the date? I go, what's on a Monday? And you go, Monday. You go, take her to this restaurant. I think it may be like Il Tre Merli or some Italian place in the village. And then after that, you said, go to Taormina for dessert. And I go, really? I mean, you were that specific. I said, why? You go, because Gotti comes there for coffee every Monday night, after Monday evening at like 10 o'clock. And my mouth fell open. So I take the girl to the restaurant. We have dinner. Then we walk down the block. We go down Houston. We go to Taormina. And we're sitting there. It's us and another couple. Eventually, I edited Taormina many times, but you turned me onto it. And sure enough, the car pulls up. 4 guys get out. They look around. They walk in. They look around. They snap their fingers. The other car pulls up. The guys get out. You know, like, but eventually, 12, 14 guys get out with Gotti, and they come in there and sit down at these tables and have coffee and pastry. And, you know, and you were the one that said to me, I know. I got it. Now, you are, of course, renowned, legendary in one area. But what I want to talk about first is your family and all three, you and your 2 brothers. You only have the 2 brothers? You had other brothers as well?
Well, there were 6 boys.
6 boys. 1 girl.
7 kids.
What kind of childhood did you have? What kind of work did your dad do? What kind of a home did you have where you go on to become probably the most famous still photographer in the business?
Thank you.
Your brother goes on to become a reporter for the Daily News, big paper, and your brother Pete is this legendary novelist, this legendary writer. What kind of household did you grow up in?
We were lower middle class. no money, seven kids, Park Slope,
right.
Brooklyn, back when it was a rough and tumble neighborhood.
Right.
Now it's a yuppified neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah, there were seven kids and two bedrooms. We were poor, but we weren't impoverished. We had a richness because my mom and dad, even though my dad was a drinker and my mother
wasn't.
What
did he do for a living?
He worked as an electrical wirer, which put fixtures and lights.
Sure. He was the head of trade.
Yeah. And he was in Local 3.
Right.
I didn't realize how poor I was until I went away to college up in Rochester, New York, RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology.
Right.
Great school. And I met people from all over the country who had money. And we had a struggle. I had to work up there in Rochester at a drugstore, as a cashier, just to make the dough. And I had to take student loans, of course.
So when you're growing up, and it's tough, you talk about describing. I mean, I had a similar situation in my family. We had a two-bedroom apartment. And by the time we left in 1966, 67, and we had six kids. We had my older sister and three boys on bunk beds. She slept in the same room with us. So I'm very familiar with your living
right.
arrangements.
Right.
You know, one bathroom. I mean, just insanity.
Totally.
But my point is, when did you first hold a camera? And people didn't have cameras back then. They were
right.
expensive.
I first held a camera in 1964.
Where? Who had a camera?
It was a little brownie camera that either my sister got us, my sister Kathleen. But I took pictures of my homeboys, all my friends, hanging out on park benches. And when I showed them to Pete, he said, hey, these are good. You want to think about being a photographer. And Pete was an art director then for a Greek magazine called Atlantis. You know, because he was an artist, he had gone to Pratt. That's where he met Redford, at Pratt.
Right.
He and Redford were buddies. So he actually ended up buying my first good camera, which was like a $100 camera called Miranda. Then, of course, all the rich kids at RIT had Nikons.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, I put together enough bread to get a Nikon. And RIT was just a great school.
Did you stay there and graduate from RIT?
No. After 2 years, I couldn't afford the tuition for the third year. None of us had, you know, I took the student loans. So I said, well, what I'll do is I'll take off for a year and come back. But in that year that I took off, I got drafted. And I had to go in the Army. So I was in the Army from 66 to 68.
And where'd you go?
Actually, I ended up going to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which is right outside of D.C. I did volunteer to go to Vietnam because I wanted to shoot photographs. I said, let me cover the war, you know?
Yeah.
But my kid brother, John, may he rest in peace, he joined the Army when he was 17, became a paratrooper, the 173rd Airborne, and went to Vietnam. So when I volunteered, because he joined before I got drafted, I put in the orders to transfer and everything, and I went before the colonel in the section I was in, and he said, why do you want to go to Vietnam? I said, I'm a photographer. I was in RIT and blah, blah, blah. I gave him the whole spiel. And he said, do you have any relatives there? I said, yeah, my kid brother's there. He said, oh, okay. Well, let us digest all that, and then we'll give you an answer. And I got turned down for the colonel. I never ended up going to Vietnam. And I thought later, gee, I wonder if it was the guy, I'm not going to say his name, because he may have kids and grandkids, who was the civilian who ran the museum. He was very attached to me. He liked me, and he knew that I did a good job, because I went to the Pentagon, and I got pictures from the 173rd Airborne, thinking I'd run into pictures of my kid brother.
Right.
And I designed an exhibit that in my brain was kind of an anti-war exhibit because they were very graphic.
Right.
And so that was up in the thing, and it became a popular exhibit in the museum there.
At the Fort. Right.
Yeah.
Now, when you're doing this, Dennis was working in the trade like your old man. He didn't emerge as a writer till when?
Dennis started writing for the Village Voice, and an editor who read The Voice, liked his pieces.
From the Daily News.
No, it was for the L.A. Herald Examiner in L.A.
Right.
You know.
So, I remember that paper.
And Dennis had to learn how to drive to be able to take the gig because he didn't know how to drive.
How long was he out there?
He was out there for a few years.
Oh, wow.
And then the editor took over the Herald in Boston. But I got to backtrack. You know who Dennis's landlord was at the time?
In L.A.
Schwarzenegger in L.A., yeah. So later on when I met Schwarzenegger, I said, hey, my kid brother told me you were a good landlord. He said, oh, how does he know? I said, well, he lived in the building that you owned. He said, what was his name? I said, Dennis Hamill. He goes, Dennis Hamill? Man, could that guy drink a lot of beer.
And what about Pete? When did he start his career?
Well, he was at Atlantis, the graphic designer, and he wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Post back when it was a very left-wing paper, not how it is now.
Right.
And the guy called him, the editor, James Wexler was his name, and said, how would you like to be a reporter? He said, oh, I'd love it. Because your letter was fabulous. I don't know what the content, I never saw the original letter. But he went in and they gave him a tryout, and he had never typed before. So he gave him a 1 week or a 2 week tryout, and he did, you know, Hunt and Peck to write his news story. So he actually covered hard news stories. But he quickly caught the eye of Paul Sand, who was the famous editor and Pete's friend and just a terrific guy and a good writer himself. He decided to think about having Pete be a columnist. And he actually, and James Wexler was, you know, with Dorothy Schiff, who owned the paper at that time, was in the hierarchy. But Paul Sand was the day-to-day, dayside editor. And he gave Pete a tryout as a columnist, and he became the youngest columnist of that paper. He was 24, and that's where he started.
Now, for you, because I don't want to overemphasize in this discussion because you're from such a famous family, but I, of course, can't be remiss and underemphasize what you eventually become and how you wind up working with the biggest people in the business, the greatest film directors. What's the beginnings of your role in the movie industry? How does that start?
I was doing a lot of journalism,
right. You
know, for different magazines. You know, all the famous magazines.
And working a lot.
And working a lot, yeah, freelance.
Right.
But, and somebody said to me, Pete wrote a film, which didn't end up being very good. It was directed by Frank Perry, about Doc Holliday.
Mm-hmm.
So Pete got me to do stills on that movie, which was shot in Almeria, Spain. And while I was there, I met Jerry Hirschfeld, was the cameraman, and his son was the assistant, Alec. And Alec said, you should get in the union. So I said, yeah, I'd love to get in the union. So I could do both, the journalism, because that's always in my blood, journalism. But I ended up getting into the union. But I had to take a test first. And one of the questions on the test, after I filled out the application, was, how do you photograph a man with a bald head? So I thought about it. Oh, this is so, like...
Random.
Yeah, random, and it depends on your taste. So I just, the answer I put in, you put a hat on him. Put a hat on his head.
And they gave you a scholarship.
And the guy who read the thing said, that's the funniest answer I've ever heard. That's not what we meant. I said, well, yeah, it's, you know, it depends. You could shoot it with available light. You could shoot it with a strobe. You could shoot it by a window. Doesn't matter. You know, it was a kind of lame thing to keep people out of the union.
Right.
Now everybody gets into the union,
but, right.
Which is a good thing.
Your career, the movies you did stills on, because I want to explain to people, when I was younger, there was a still man or woman on the set a lot. The stills photography was something where it was cast specific. So let's say you're doing a movie and Hackman's only in for 2 weeks. You get the still unit in there to shoot the stills because he's only there for 2 weeks. But there were stills around a lot.
Right.
And some movies, the big movies, when you had the biggest stars, if you're doing something with Leo or someone, then the stills are there every day.
Right.
It's worth it. You know, I mean, you want great still photography. And nowadays, I just did a film. I went to go finish this film in Montana. And we had stills there for 2 days. The woman comes in for 2 days.
Yeah.
Cast specific. Stills for me were always this thing where I only act for one camera. There's the movie camera. But I do this thing where I'd almost look right into the camera and position my body right toward the movie camera.
Right.
And when I would go off into that reverie of going, oh, Bob, you got to remember when my dad was alive. And I go like, and I play it right into the fucking camera.
Right.
But let's not look down the barrel of the lens. And my point is that if there was another camera, there was still camera, I'd go nuts. I'd take the first AD. I'd say, get him out of here.
Mm.
I'll pose. They can shoot the rehearsals. Later on, I'll step. When they cut the camera, we'll pose and do it for them. But I don't want that camera in my eye
right.
when I'm shooting. I'm assuming for you there were rhythms you had to learn and there's things you had to learn about shooting because you shot the biggest stars in movie history.
Right.
What was that like for you to learn how to do that properly?
Well, you have to be discreet, but you have to get your work done. You can't tell the studio later on when they get see an inferior set of stills, hey, the guy was tough. You know, the actor was a pain in the ass. That's not an excuse. They just want to see end results. For instance, when I worked on Raging Bull, De Niro had an eyeline problem, but he would always accommodate me. He was so sweet about it. You know, he's, of course, up there near the top of my favorite actors, and he's a good human being.
Great guy.
Great guy. So he would always accommodate me, and then sometimes I'd get away with just grabbing stuff.
Mm.
And he didn't mind, but he would always not make a big deal out of it. He'd just do it with a hand gesture, like,
right.
you know. And then he'd say, he'd mouth it, I'll do it for you after.
Right.
Which
I'd always do it for them after we cut.
Yeah. And the same thing with Chris Walken. Very sweet, very nice. He was in Annie Hall. And, you know,
an eyeline issue.
The eyeline thing.
Right.
But it's so funny. When I worked with De Niro again years later on Sleepers, the Barry Levinson movie,
right.
I said, Bob, let me know if, you know, just do the same thing you did last time. He said, no, I don't have that problem anymore.
Interesting.
You can just shoot away.
Right. Interesting.
And some actors just let you shoot away, like Dustin Hoffman and Jimmy Kahn. Never, you know, I worked with him, and he's a character. I loved him. And, you know, Nicholson was great. No eyeline problem.
Without naming names, though, because I'm when you said that before about not wanting to name names because they have children or grandchildren, I'm not out to, you know, bury anybody either. But
that was the guy who brought in whiskey and Listerine bottles.
Yeah, I remember. But what I'm saying is, are there actors, without naming names, who that you have some difficulty with, and how do you win them over? How do you get the job done? As you said, the boss wants the pictures. What do you
right.
do?
I tell them this is my job.
Right.
This is how I make my living.
Right.
I got a little rough with Sam Shepard on a Woody Allen movie. He said, no stills. I said, well, you'll do it for me afterward. He said, no stills. First day of shooting. And I walked up to him at the end of the day. I still kept trying to grab stuff. And I said, listen, you know, I don't want to be forceful, but this is what I do for a living. You know, if you're not going to do it for me afterward, I can understand you don't want me to shoot during the take.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he said, I don't want to have this discussion. No stills. I says, all right, then we can go outside and settle with these. And he looked at me, and there was a PA, you know, PAs walked him back and forth to the dressing room, and he ran upstairs to the producer, the line producer, Bobby Greenhut, sweet man.
I know Bobby.
Yeah, great guy.
I remember Bobby.
And he told him, hey, the still photographer just threatened me. And Bobby Greenhut goes, what do you mean? He goes, well, he wanted to take me outside. And he's a tall guy, Sam Shepard.
Yeah.
Pete had written a New York Magazine article about him. So that night I called Pete and I said, Pete, this guy gave me a hard time. I think he's a prick. He goes, no, he's probably just, you know, intimidated by Woody or whatever. And, you know, just calm down about it. I didn't even tell Pete that I threatened the guy. But Woody being Woody, he said, Greeno, tell me what you did. I'm so happy you did that. Later on, I ran into Sam Shepard in the village, and he couldn't have been nicer. And he turned out to be a nice guy, and we'd have coffee and a joint in the village a lot together.
photojournalist Brian Hamill. If you enjoy conversations with brilliant photographers, check out my episode with Pete Souza, White House photographer for both Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama.
The most interesting part of my job was that I saw him in all these different compartments of his life. I saw him as a dad. I saw how he behaved with his children. I saw him when he was on the basketball court. Most competitive guy I've ever met in my life. The general public doesn't see that, but I saw that part of him. One rule that everybody at the White House staff knew was that 6:30 or 7 o'clock, he was having dinner with his family.
Right.
Full stop.
Right. To hear more of my conversation with Pete Souza, go to heresthething.org. After the break, Brian Hamill shares the backstory of how some of the most memorable images of John Lennon came to be.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver.
Yeah! I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger, and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC+.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Brian Hamill is known for his photos from some of the most significant films in history. In fact, one of his early jobs on set led to the iconic movie poster for Woody Allen's film Manhattan. I wanted to know if Hamill set out to take the one lucky frame that became the poster, or was it just another behind-the-scenes shot?
No, it was when Gordon Willis, may he rest in peace, phenomenal talent.
I worked with Gordy.
Yeah, phenomenal talent. He took a long time to light it, but once stuff is lit by Gordon, it goes like clockwork. And when I saw how gorgeous it looked, I had one of the grips get me a ladder so I could get up on the ladder and get a good, you know, composition that was close to Gordon's composition. And bingo. I shot about 8 or 9 frames, and Woody, who doesn't like to do many takes, said, let's move on, you know.
I'm going to tell 2 quick stories. One time I do Malice, this very tepid thriller I did with Nicole Kidman and Bill Pullman, and Gordy was the DP, and Harold Becker was the director. And Harold, who was like a Jewish gangster out of Brooklyn with that accent of his and that voice of his, Harold and Gordy are there, and they're standing there together talking. Gordon, I think it was day one, and Gordon turns around and he goes, would everybody here shut up? He screams at the crew. And we all looked at each other like, wow, this is not at all what I had in mind, you know what I mean? And I realized, I said, I needed to go the other way. I needed to fight through the wall. So I go up to Gordy the next day, and I go, hey, I mean, I see you're here at the crack of dawn and you're on your feet getting everything set up. I go, can I get you a cup of coffee? He goes, yeah, sure. I'll take a cup of coffee. How do you like it? And I like it with milk and 2 sugars or whatever the fuck it was. I go get him, and I brought him his coffee every morning that I worked. And he could not have been nicer to me. It's like something simple like that. He could not have been nicer to me. Now, all of Woody's movies, all of his oeuvre, it's just, it saved my life. It saved my life. Because when I really needed to take my mind off my problems, that's the only thing that worked like gangbusters. Now, who was a director who, you're a photographer, and you have an eye, and you talk about composition and ladders and Gordy and all this other stuff.
Right.
Who was a director who you learned from? Did you learn from anybody when you were watching them shoot films?
Oh, sure. Well, of course, Scorsese was, that was a master class for me. And filmmaking.
Michael Chapman.
Michael Chapman was, you know, legendary DP. And he had been Gordy's operator.
Right. The Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Chapman was the DP. What's it like for you to be on a movie set and you're shooting these people? And do you get like a real, or not now, because you've done it forever and you're... And I want to get to John Lennon in a minute, but was it just like really like a high for you? Did you sit there and go, I can't believe I'm on the fucking set of this movie while they're making this, and you could tell it's great while it's unfolding.
Yeah, on good movies.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the beginning of my career, I worked on like a half a dozen garbage can movies.
Right.
Even while I was in the union, you know, you got to work your way up to get, and I actually, the first really terrific movie I worked on was Annie Hall.
Right.
Actually, The Gambler was a good movie with Jimmy, Kahn.
With Jimmy Kahn, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, do you stop at some point? Is there a time where you just stop and you don't want to be on sets anymore? Did it run its course and you were like, I think this is my last movie? What happened?
Well, my career got kind of fucked up when I got throat cancer.
Right.
I had to take off for a year.
And you got that what year?
I got the surgery done in 2000. And then I had it dipped into 2001 with the radiation, which is, you know.
Do you remember running into me on the street?
Well, yes.
I'm cutting a film.
Yeah.
The only film I ever made that I directed, I hated every minute of it. I hate directing.
You looked at me and
said, I didn't know who you were.
43rd Street.
Because Manganaro was around the corner to go get lunch. I was on 43rd, I can't believe you, your fucking memory is unbelievable. I'm on 43rd Street. And down that block between 9th and 10th was the editing house. And next door, I go out and smoke a cigarette. I get out of the editing room and go smoke a cigarette, and then and the firehouse was next door.
Right.
And, you know, like, I don't know what percent, like 80% of the guys in that unit were killed in 9/11 that September.
Including Patty Brown.
I ran into you on the corner, and you said to me, Alec, I took a look at you. I didn't even know who you were.
Yeah, because my head was swollen. So.
Yeah, and your face was swollen. And,
yeah.
And you told me what happened to you. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Stage 4 cancer.
And so, all gone. You're good.
Oh, yeah, I'm good now.
But would you say that was the cause of interrupting your...
Well, I put a hurting on my career for a year and a half. But my 2 North Stars, Woody and Barry Levinson, both hired me right away.
Right.
You know, when I was good enough to work. And I did another 10 or 15 movies after I healed up.
What's the last movie you did?
The last movie I did was, it might have been with you, with Michael Corrente.
No.
In 2006.
Did we do...
It was called Brooklyn Rules.
Brooklyn Rules with Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the last one I did with Corrente. Before that, I did Outside Providence that he adapted from the
right.
Farrelly Brothers book.
Right.
But yeah, and Corrente, he doesn't make movies anymore, right? He's...
Well, no, he just shot a pilot.
Did he?
That he sent to me, and it's good.
No.
It's a good pilot.
Outside Providence
about
was
wise
fun.
Guys in Federal Hill, right, you know.
Exactly.
And that's his...
That's bread and
his hometown. That's
yeah,
his milieu, you know.
That's
and it's good. I hope it gets picked up. You know, he's a nice guy. He's a determined guy.
Well, when he focuses, he's a classic example of a director who needed a good producer so he could just focus on making the movie.
Right.
Like when we made the movie Outside Providence, he would literally walk up to me and, I mean, who's funnier than Corrente? He was a very yeah. funny guy.
Yeah.
Now, talk to me about Lennon. You had a big exhibit.
Well, I have a book. That came
right,
out.
Right.
I had an exhibit. The last exhibit I had of my Lennon pictures was in a terrific gallery in Rhinebeck, New York,
right.
The Betsy Giacaruso Gallery.
Right.
But my Lennon pictures have been displayed in New Mexico at a terrific gallery that only does black and white stuff down there, and the Peter Federman Gallery in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But the last exhibit I had of those photographs was some of those photographs, not all of the ones in the book. You wrote the foreword for the book.
Right, right, right.
And I wrote
How did that come about? How did the relationship with Lennon come about?
I got an assignment from a Sunday supplement in 1972 after I'd started working on movies. I did concurrently photojournalism. And Pete had done a piece on him years earlier, when it was the Beatles, he did a piece on the Beatles for the Saturday Evening Post. And he had written some columns defending him. Because remember that he went through that whole ordeal where they were trying to, you know, not let him stay in New York.
Kick him out of the country.
Yeah, and kick him out and everything. And Pete defended him in a cluster of columns. I think it was the Post at that time, when Pete was a columnist for the Post. So I said, are you still in touch with Lennon? He said, yeah. I said, I just got an assignment from this magazine, a Sunday supplement. And he said, yeah, you should do it. I said, well, how do I get in touch with him? He said, well, I'll call him. So he called him. And the next day, he said, yeah, tell your brother to come by tomorrow. He lived in a village at 105 Bank Street at this time. And I had already shot the concert at the Garden, which was in August of 71. There was a concert that John and Yoko did there. It was a benefit concert for Willowbrook with, you know, Geraldo Rivera.
Exactly.
Remember,
yep.
He was a champion of...
Made his career.
Yeah. Anyway, I go over there and I decided, hey, listen, meet the John Lennon. Let me take all these photographs. And they were already being distributed through the agency I had then, I worked on with then, called Photo Reporters. So I got some, you know, silver gelatin 8x10s made up. And I figured at some point I'm going to give it to John and Yoko, these prints. But I'm not going to do it right away because I don't want them to think I was a brown nose.
Right.
So I ring the bell and I figured, you know, it's going to be makeup, hair, publicist, and all the bullshit that goes on when you photograph a star. And I hear the voice saying, yeah, come on up. The apartment was a couple of flights, the top floor. So he answered the door himself. And he stuck out his hand and he goes, hey, Brian, John. Like, okay. Yeah,
it's a good start.
He goes, would you like a cuppa? And, you know, being Irish and he's English with Irish roots. He was offering me tea, but I was still a little nervous, and I figured, you know, I'm going to go in, I'm going to see the whole team, you know, that he's got behind him. And I walked in through, I declined the tea, and I walked into the room, and the only person there besides John was Yoko. And they gave me all the time in the world I needed.
Why do you think he did that?
He was just a nice guy.
Yeah.
He was a solid guy.
And maybe he craved just normal exchanges with people and normal
right.
moments with people after having so much insanity. And, just...
and you know, I photographed him there, I don't know, 45 minutes. And then he said, you got enough? And I said, I'd love to get you walking the streets. He said, yeah, let's do it. So the two of us, the three of us, Yoko came, and we walked around the village. And people would stop them, but not like, you know, starstruck. They were just New Yorkers in the village. Yeah. Hey, John, that was blah, blah, blah. And he was, listened to all of them. He was a good listener. He wasn't like, he didn't, you know, try to cut people short. The same with Yoko. She was exceedingly nice. And all the bullshit about, all the negativity about her really bugs the shit out of me to this day because she's a nice person.
Brian Hamill, if you're enjoying this conversation, tell a friend and be sure to follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Brian Hamill shares his experience working in Northern Ireland during the Troubles.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver.
Yeah! I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger, and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Photojournalist Brian Hamill has been lucky enough to be present for some remarkable cultural moments, but he's also been present to capture moments of strife and conflict. The Troubles in Ireland, the 1994 Northridge earthquake, and sadly, the assassination of Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles in 1968.
Pete was very friendly with Bobby, and I had met Bobby in the village, and he had a beer, and Pete introduced me to him. So Pete went to Ireland to work on his first novel, and Pete sent him a letter saying, you have to run for president. Basically, he sent it from Ireland. Bobby wrote him back a letter and said, I need you back here. And Pete had just finished his first novel, which was called A Killing for Christ, a thriller. So he came back, and then he said to me, let's go to L.A. together. I had just gotten out of the army. I should precede this by saying Martin Luther King got assassinated.
April 4th.
Yeah, April 4th, and I got out a couple of days later. I'll never forget the phone call. my mother called me crying on the phone. So anyway, we got out to L.A., Pete and I, and we ended up at the Ambassador Hotel. We were up in the room, the hotel room, before he went down to give that speech, the victory speech, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was supposed to go out the back of the ballroom. And then Pete was up on the stage near Bobby, right near, and I was shooting this way in the crowd.
In the crowd.
Shooting up. And Pete said, he gestured for me, come around the curtain. And I made my way up there. I said, like that, we're going out this way, through the kitchen. But anyway, I walked right by Sirhan. I was from here to, I don't know, 30 feet beyond where he actually got murdered, maybe 25 feet, because I wanted to have the candidate come to me so I could photograph him coming at me, you know, in the kitchen. So I was all set, and then boom, 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 boom. And my heart sank. I went, holy shit. And I could hear somebody screaming, no Jack Rubies, no Jack Rubies. I don't know who that ever was, but Pete was right there. It was next to Rosie Greer, and he was, you know.
Yep.
He saw the whole thing go down, and luckily, you know, five people got shot.
Well, interesting how divided the family was about Sirhan's parole.
Yeah.
Some, you know, Bobby Kennedy Jr. said he sat with him and said, this guy didn't kill my dad.
That's what he thinks, but...
And other members of the family were, you know, vehement about him not getting any parole. I mean, I have a lot of opinions about that because I'm kind of a conspiracy nut about both assassinations. And when people talk about the angle that Sirhan was at compared to where the gun was shot into his mastoid, you know, there's a lot of questions there.
Yeah, Bobby Jr. is very into that.
Yeah, completely. Now, one last question, which is, you shot... I mean, I don't like this blanket term. It's a little tedious to me, but you shot The Troubles over in Ireland. You were over there doing some photography. Who were you on assignment for that?
The New York Times Magazine.
Right. When was that?
1972, right after Bloody Sunday.
So this is a very busy time for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You're making 70s, movies.
The 70s were where it was at for my career.
Right.
Yeah.
And what did you see over there?
Well, I was lucky because my parents were from Belfast, so I had a kind of a hook with the IRA, honestly. Certain people.
No comment.
Yeah. Right. And I got introduced to Martin McGuinness, who sort of put me under his wing. And you talk about a guy with balls. You know, the Brits, and he said, they're going to be shooting at us. He told me. I said, yeah, I'm down. So they did. They shot at us. And if you look at the...
You wanted to go to Vietnam. Here was your chance.
Yeah, exactly.
Get shot at.
And actually... Pete came over because he was doing a piece for New York Magazine. So some of the photographs were also in the New York Magazine with Pete's piece. But Gail Sheehy wrote the piece where I did the photos for the New York Times Magazine. But Martin McGuinness, what a sterling guy he was. He was the head of the provost, and he was young. He was like 22 or something. He was younger than I was. I think I was 20, 24 or 25 when I was there. But, you know, when you're that young, you feel like you're immortal, you know.
Photojournalist Brian Hamill. You can see some of Brian's work in person at the Betsy Hakaruso Gallery in Rhinebeck, New York, on October 9th. His photos of John Lennon will be on display in honor of what would have been the musician's 83rd birthday. This episode was recorded at CDM Studios in New York City. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Zach McNeese, and Maureen Hoban. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Our social media manager is Danielle Gingrich. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit RightRug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.